Okay, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and once again, we have a packed but thrilling show for you today, all right? So stay tuned to the whole thing. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Noche Diaz. Noche is a young revolutionary based in New York City who is facing many charges and many years in jail for standing up against police brutality and in defense of people against that brutality. So keep tuned in for that one. You don't want to miss that. Before that, we'll be talking with David Lindorf. Dave is a journalist with This Can't Be Happening, and he has a piece that was recently featured in Counterpunch called The Big Lie About Police Brutality, a Nationwide Epidemic. All right, so stay tuned for that one as well. And I am really pleased to welcome to the show our first guest, and that is Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her most recent book is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And Marjorie's blog is marjoriecohen.com. That's C-O-H-N.com, marjoriecohen.com. And we're going to be talking with Marjorie about a very, very important subject, and that is the Obama administration and torture. But before we jump into that, there's a couple of things I want to say here. And that is that we are faced right now with a very, very terrible situation. We're faced with a situation where so many people, so many progressive people will now look at you and tell you that in relation to these elections, the stakes are too high to sit out this election. They talk about it's you can't be passive in the face of this election. And they say that the stakes are that important. And I'd say that, yes, the stakes are important, and it's precisely for that reason that you have to have your eyes open, your head open, look at the truth, and decide to act accordingly. And frankly, the way that people who really want change need to participate in this election is to expose the bankruptcy of the whole process. And that is why we are about to launch, between now and the election day, we are about to launch a little series that will be happening sometimes on a weekly basis, sometimes a little bit more spaced out, but a series that will be bringing you the truth that you don't get in these elections from any quarter, but bringing you the truth about particularly what Obama is saying, what he's saying and what he's done, and what he means for the people of the world. And let's just put a stop to the accusations at the very beginning, because this is no way meant an endorsement of Romney or anyone else. Frankly, Obama and Romney are both bad. Okay, they're both bad for the people, and that's enough said on that. But we do have to say that if people are serious about wanting change in the world, they're serious about standing up against oppression, about wanting a whole new world, then you got to open your eyes up to the truth. And that's what we're talking with Marjorie Cohen about today. This is the first installment in that series, which maybe we'll just start calling it the Give Me Some Truth series, all right? And that's what we need, some truth. So Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael.
You know, I can't help but say, you know, when I saw you did a piece recently that was called No Accountability for Torturers. And I thought, this is the person that I want to have open up this series that we're doing on Give Me Some Truth, and the truth about elections, the truth about, you know, Obama and what's going on under Obama. And a thing that there's sort of a serious predicament we're in now, and it's something Bob Avakian pointed out, where there's a lot of people, a lot of progressive and liberal people in this country these days. They have a certain peculiar kind of Oedipus complex. It's not so much that they want to sleep with their mother, but they willfully blind themselves. And so much of that has happened over the last 4 years and continues to happen now that it poses a tremendous threat for all of humanity. And you seem to be hitting on a very important, you are hitting, not seem to be hitting, but you are hitting on a very important element of this. And this is what Obama is doing in relation to torture and in relation to all the things that went on before him, in a way, even his extension of the Bush regime's program on this front in terms of torture, international relations, all this other stuff. So I wanted to talk to you about that. You just wrote this article titled No Accountability for Tortures. What's going on here?
Well, during the Bush administration, officials and their legal mercenaries, John Yoo, J. Bybee, etc., devised a system of torture and abuse which was then carried out on unknown numbers of people, probably thousands of people, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, at Guantanamo, in the CIA black sites, where they were subjected to torture and cruel treatment. And there was an investigation launched by Eric Holder, the Attorney General. Actually, career prosecutor Durham was assigned to look at any possible liability, not on the part of the officials of the Bush administration or their lawyers, but interrogators. And that investigation was circumscribed by the so-called torture memos. So if the interrogators were following the advice in the torture memos, and the torture memos are full of horrible and illegal authorizations, but if they were following the advice in the torture memos, then they would not be investigated. So the investigation was narrowed to interrogators who did things so egregious that they weren't even permitted by the torture memos. And in June of last year, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that his office would investigate only two incidents in which CIA interrogators were involved in interrogations that ended in deaths. Holder said at the time that the Justice Department has determined that an expanded criminal investigation of the remaining matters is not warranted, unquote. Of course, the remaining matters are the probably thousands of people who have been subjected to torture and abuse. And the two incidents were egregious. They involved the deaths of two men, one Ghul Rahman and the other Monadelle Al-Jamadi. Rahman froze to death in 2002. He was stripped and shackled to a cold cement floor in the salt pit, the secret Afghan prison called the salt pit. Al-Jamadi died after he was suspended from the ceiling by his wrists, which were bound behind his back. And Tony Diaz, an MP who witnessed Al-Jamadi's torture, said that blood gushed from his mouth like a faucet had turned on when he was lowered to the ground. Al-Jamadi's death was classified as a homicide after a military autopsy. So we have these two egregious incidents which were being investigated. And just last week, Eric Holder announced that based upon the record, there is not sufficient evidence to obtain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So he is closing the books on any investigation or prosecution of any torture and abuse that happened during the Bush administration.
We're talking with Marjorie Cohen about the Obama administration taking the Bush regime's torture agenda to higher places than ever imagined. Now, Marjorie, tell me this. Okay, this amnesty is happening despite the characterizations by people that are fairly high up in the ranks of people that run the country, fairly high-ranking military officers, who was a General Barry McCaffrey and Major General Anthony Tacuba, that actually, if you were looking for evidence, these are people that made some pretty damning comments about what the hell was going on in reference to torturing of people held prisoner by the U.S.
Yes, General Barry McCaffrey said, and I'm quoting, "We tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of that, both the armed forces and the CIA," unquote. And Major General Anthony Tacuba, who oversaw the Abu Ghraib investigation, wrote, quote, "There is no longer any doubt as to whether the Bush administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account," unquote. And Eric Holder has answered that question, and that is, no, they will not. Now, by the way, when he says that members of the Bush administration committed war crimes, torture is considered a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. And I want to say that when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The Geneva Conventions mandate that we either prosecute or extradite to another country where they will prosecute those who commit or are complicit in the commission of torture. And another treaty we've ratified, the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, mandates that we prosecute or extradite those who commit or are complicit in the commission of torture. So because under the Constitution, it's called the Take Care Clause, it requires that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, Obama now, in order to fulfill his legal duty under the Constitution, now that his administration has decided they're not going to prosecute these people, under the Torture Convention and the Geneva Conventions, specifically Article 7 of the Convention Against Torture, mandates that we extradite Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and the rest of the torture group, John U.J. Bybee, to another country where they will investigate and prosecute them under universal jurisdiction. Now, keep in mind, Michael, that when Eric Holder closed the books on the investigation of these final two incidents, he said the admissible evidence would not be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. Let's take him at his word and assume that's true. That doesn't mean that there isn't probable cause, a much lower standard, probable cause to believe that people had violated our laws. And since there's probable cause to believe they engaged in torture and cruel treatment, then under the Convention Against Torture and under the Geneva Conventions, our administration has a duty to extradite, send these people to other countries where they will be prosecuted. What are the chances of that happening? Zero.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Now, Marjorie, that gets me right to what I wanted to get to, which was I'm listening to you, and I'm realizing that, look, a lot of progressive people voted for Obama in 2008. Actually, a lot of them were hoping that he would do something about this situation with torture, which is really a very, you know, grievous crime against humanity that had been done sort of openly and flaunting it, and we got the right to do this, and all of these things from the renditioning to the just the open admission of torture, all the stuff that was shown at Abu Ghraib, all of the things, all the various exposures. It was just sort of like, so what? We're doing it. Live with it. And then people voted for Obama hoping that something would be done. But in fact, as you're pointing out, nothing has been done. And that in itself, as you're saying, I think, is that refusing to prosecute these torturers is itself a violation of this law.
It is. And Manfred Novak, who is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, said that during the Bush administration, he was getting almost daily complaints about torture. He said that when Obama came into power, he was not getting those complaints, but he was concerned about the failure to hold people accountable. And although I do not see any evidence that torture is occurring on Obama's watch, at least in other countries, there is still torture going on in the supermax prisons in this country in the form of solitary confinement and cell extractions. That's covered in one of the chapters in the United States and Torture. But solitary confinement, experts say, can lead to hallucinations, catatonia, suicide. But there is no evidence that I've seen that the Obama administration is engaging in torture. But there was one thing that really concerned me and should give other people pause, and that is when General Petraeus was testifying before Congress to be confirmed as the incoming CIA director, he said there might be some incidents where we might have to return to enhanced techniques, enhanced interrogation. That's another word for torture. So although I don't see evidence that that's actually happening, he left that door open, which is worrisome.
Which leads me to two questions, Marjorie. And the first one being, there is a situation in the world right now where one of the ways that they've dealt with sort of the question of renditioning, they dealt with actually even these enhanced interrogations, well, there's a place, Bagram, that so little is known by that. This is a black site that they continue to maintain. And from what I've heard in with past guests and from what I've read in various sources, Bagram currently holds somewhere over 3,000 people, and they just applied for the permission to increase that number by 5,500. And no one has any idea what's going on inside Bagram.
Well, the Obama administration turned over most of the prisoners at Bagram to the Afghans, I think it was yesterday or the day before. But yes, there have been allegations of torture coming out of Bagram. And the Bush administration denied habeas corpus to prisoners at Guantanamo. Habeas corpus means that a person has a right to go before a neutral judge, a federal judge, and say, I'm innocent, I should be released. And the Bush administration maintained that since Guantanamo was on Cuban soil, not U.S. soil, that these prisoners weren't entitled to habeas corpus. The Supreme Court said, oh, no, that's not true. In Boumediene, the Supreme Court said that you cannot keep someone out of court just by locating a prison 90 miles off your shore and saying it's on Cuban soil because the United States exercises complete jurisdiction and control over Guantanamo. So they settled that issue for Guantanamo. But what about Bagram? And there is an argument that it is part of the battlefield, although once somebody is taken off the battlefield and put in the Bagram prison, they're no longer on the battlefield. So those prisoners have not been entitled to habeas corpus, and they have been entitled to a very, very reduced level of due process, if at all. So, yes, it's very difficult to know what's going on there.
And then the other question is, and again, you've answered this in some ways, this question of all of the various international conventions, and I'm thinking in particular of the U.S. Torture Convention and the War Crimes Act, they're pretty unequivocal around this, that nothing is ever a justification for torture. These international conventions, which nations that sign onto them are obliged to follow, yet the U.S. turn around and they're arguing that there may be justification for this kind of thing when these things all say there's no justification for torture at all.
Right. Well, you had the chief legal mercenary, John Yoo, who is now a professor at Berkeley, teaches constitutional law, by the way, teaches it in an undisclosed location. So that if you want to take John Yoo's course, you're sworn to secrecy. I wonder what he's afraid of.
So that explains.
But he came up with these incredible meaning unbelievable, arguments justifying the torture and abuse. John Yoo, Dick Cheney, and George W. Bush still maintain to this day that waterboarding is not torture, and they're proud that they participated in the decision to waterboard and they would do it again. Waterboarding has long been considered to be torture. The United States prosecuted, convicted, and hung Japanese military leaders after World War II for waterboarding as torture. And by the way, Mitt Romney also maintains that he would engage in waterboarding, you know, authorized waterboarding. He doesn't think it constitutes torture either.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States and Torture. And we're talking with Marjorie about the Obama administration and torture. Now, Marjorie, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is when you brought up you and actually your explanation of you teaching in an undisclosed site. You know, this is an insane thing we've got going on here. And at the same time, it's such a criminal scene. And when you think about this, one of the things, again, when people thought that Obama would stop the Bush program, that it would entail bringing to justice the people who had put into practice and given the legal justification and all this were part of these heinous crimes against humanity, would be brought to justice. And in fact, nothing has happened. But I don't know how much people really understand the significance of him refusing to prosecute you and Bybee.
Right. You know, some people say, well, these are lawyers. They were just giving their clients legal advice. You can't go after them. And in fact, there is precedent for holding lawyers accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that is United States versus Altstetter, where the United States government, after the Holocaust, actually tried and convicted Nazi lawyers of war crimes and crimes against humanity for advising Hitler on how he could legally, and I put that in quotes, legally disappear people to concentration camps and get away with it. So there is precedent for this. One other thing that I want to say, Michael, is that while the Obama administration is not pursuing accountability for these people, they are going after whistleblowers in a very heavy way. For example, pursuing criminal charges against John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer, on charges that he disclosed the identity of other CIA officers who participated in interrogations. Arresting and holding Bradley Manning on charges that could get him life in prison. Bradley Manning, by the way, was subjected to torture when he was in the first 9 months of his incarceration in a military brig. He was held in solitary confinement, which, as I've said, many people say amounts to torture. He was also subjected to humiliating and degrading treatment, which also violates that treaty, the same treaty, by being paraded naked in front of other inmates. It was only after people, including, I'm proud to say, 250 law professors, wrote a letter to the Obama administration saying this is unacceptable, that Bradley Manning was actually transferred to another prison in Fort Leavenworth, where he is now in the general population. Another example, Julian Assange, who is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because he is afraid that London will extradite him to Sweden just for questioning. They haven't charged him with anything in Sweden. He has agreed to make himself available in the Ecuadorian embassy for questioning. But the Swedes, who you know are getting a lot of pressure from the United States, are saying, no, we want him extradited to Sweden. And then the fear is, and there's good reason for it, that Sweden would then extradite him to the United States where he could face espionage charges. For publishing publishing, allegedly publishing on WikiLeaks memos and documents allegedly given to WikiLeaks by Bradley Manning, many of which show evidence of war crimes by the Bush administration. And yet the New York Times didn't do anything different than WikiLeaks in publishing this information, and you don't see the Obama administration going after the New York Times. But they are coming down very hard on whistleblowers, not at all on war criminals.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States in Torture. And we're talking with Marjorie about the Obama administration and torture. Now, Marjorie, again, it's amazing to think of each time you want to say it's more heinous than before, but it's all just very, very, very disturbing and very enraging. And this is the question of the kill list. Where is the uproar? That's what I want to know. Where is the uproar around this, that this guy actually has a kill list? Extrajudicial killings are perfectly fine, and no one's really out in the streets about it.
No, you're right. Joe Becker and Scott Shane reported a few months ago in the New York Times that Obama has a kill list, that after he consults with his counterterrorism advisor, John O. Brennan, then Obama personally makes a decision to have people executed. Brennan, you might recall, was closely identified with torture in secret prisons and extraordinary rendition during the Bush administration. And this Times story, which was based on interviews with 36 current and former Obama advisors, says that basically Obama is avoiding the complications of detaining additional people like in Guantanamo, which he has been unable to close because Congress has used it as a political football. But what he does is he kills them, takes no prisoners, so he doesn't have to worry about where they're being held. And this is really outrageous. I mean, it's illegal, and it also is ineffective. It actually backfires because when people in other countries, Somalia, Pakistan, Yemen, see the U.S. drones dropping bombs on and killing many, many civilians, and the Obama administration defines civilians selectively. In other words, if you're a boy of military age and you're in a certain area, then you're not considered to be a civilian. And so they say, well, the number of civilians killed with these drones has been in single digits, and people just don't believe that. I mean, there have been studies that some 957 deaths in Pakistan in 2010 from the drones. But when these people see civilians being killed by these U.S. drones, it makes them hate us even more, not less. And what just came out, and actually a couple of days ago in The Guardian, was an article by Chris Woods from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London talking about a drone strike in Yemen on Sunday in the Yemeni city of Rada'a, where at least 10 civilians were killed, many women and children, and how the Yemeni government has actually taken credit for these drone attacks, and the Musharraf government in Pakistan as well, so that the CIA will not be blamed, which is interesting. First of all, if the Obama administration claims that drone attacks are legal, why are they covering up that they're using them? And secondly, what propelled the governments of Yemen and Pakistan to take credit for these drone attacks when this would really anger their people? There must be tremendous pressure applied on them. But keep in mind that these drone attacks, they're two different kinds. One are called personality strikes, which target suspected militants, right? This is no due process, no arrest, no trial. And then there's another kind, they're called signature strikes, where they don't have names of people so much as suspicious patterns of behavior in certain places controlled by a terrorist group. So if you're in that area, you can be killed by a drone. And the Obama administration says, well, you know, we have the authorization for use of military force that Congress passed just days after 9/11. But Congress rejected the Bush administration's request for open-ended military authority to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression. It just authorized force against the groups and countries that supported 9/11. And in fact, in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, Congress specifically said nothing in this section will expand the authority of the president or the scope of the authorization of the use of military force. Drone attacks violate international law. They violate the Geneva Conventions. They violate the well-established international law principle of proportionality and distinction. Proportionality means that attacks can't be excessive in relation to anticipated military advantage, and distinction requires that they be directed only at a legitimate military target. Both of these principles are being violated. So some people in the Obama administration say, say, well, this is self-defense under the UN Charter. Well, the self-defense provision of the UN Charter is a very narrow exception to the Charter's prohibition on the use of force to settle international disputes. In order to use self-defense under the UN Charter, it has to be a response to an armed attack against a UN country, or the necessity of self-defense must be imminent. And drone attacks don't meet that standard. What Obama is doing, although he's not calling it the war on terror, which is what the Bush administration called it, you know, terrorism, by the way, is a tactic. It's not an enemy. You don't declare war on a tactic. And yet, under the guise of the war on terror, Bush shredded the Constitution. Obama doesn't call it the war on terror. He calls it the war on Al-Qaeda. But what he's doing and what his administration is doing is going far beyond, even if we were entitled to go take out whoever we thought was Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world, which we're not. You know, you can't say the whole world is a battlefield. This is going way, way beyond that. And there was an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of months ago by a man named Ibrahim Mothana, and it's called How Drones Help Al-Qaeda. And he says in that op-ed, drone strikes are causing more and more Yemenis to hate America and join radical militants. They are not driven by ideology, but rather by a sense of revenge and despair. So even if they weren't illegal, even if they weren't killing civilians, they're counterproductive. They're actually making us more vulnerable to terrorism, not less.
And we have room for one more question, and it's got to be really quick. Christoph Haines, the current UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, says targeted killings may constitute war crimes. And I'd like to talk about your view on that in relation to Obama and his response. And at the same time, this point about the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that made the point that every human being has an inherent right to life that is protected by law and which no one can be arbitrarily denied this right. You know, those two things in terms of war crimes and the responsibility of the Obama regime, what's your thinking on that?
Well, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, another treaty the United States has ratified, not only says no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his life, but also says that everyone has the right to be presumed innocent till proven guilty, and they're entitled to a fair trial. You can't just take someone out if you think they're acting suspiciously. That violates that particular covenant. And in terms of Christoph Haines, you're right. He actually asked the Obama administration to explain how its drone strikes do not violate international law and specify the basis for decisions to kill rather than capture certain individuals, and whether the country in which the killing takes place has given consent, such as Yemen and Pakistan. And he also wants the procedural safeguards in place to ensure that in advance that these drone killings comply with international law, and wants to know what justice and reparations for the victims and families the Obama administration is coming forth with. And Haines said the United States has not provided a satisfactory response. So here you have Obama saying, you know, I'm the best guy to protect America by these drone strikes. And, you know, there's not a lot of criticism of the drone strikes because people get much more upset when you see lots of U.S. troops going over to, for example, Iraq and getting killed in the drone strikes. They don't even have pilots in the drones, although there are incidents that some of the pilots, you know, 6,000 miles away are using joysticks to drive these drones, have suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. But the drone strikes are illegal. They are killing civilians, and they do make us less safe.
All right, Marjorie, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael.
And I'm sure we'll have you back again soon to continue up on this whole thing of give me some truth. That's what we need.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Marjorie Cohen, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And if you want to follow Marjorie's blog, you can go to www.marjoriecohen.com, and that's MarjorieCohn.com, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back with our next guest, Dave Lindorf, who is a journalist with This Can't Be Happening, and we're going to be talking with Dave about a nationwide epidemic of police brutality. So stay tuned. Slate, welcome back. That was Police Brutality from Why Not and their album We Don't Need This. Joining us now to talk about police brutality is Dave Lindorf. Dave is a founder of This Can't Be Happening and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. And he lives in Philadelphia, and he's been a frequent guest on the show. He's also the author of one of my favorite books, Killing Time, about the railroad of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I should add I'm also a veteran of dealing with the LAPD as a journalist who was spied on by their PDID unit under Daryl Gates.
Really? Really? Well, let's start off. Tell me about that.
Well, it's back in 76 when I and some other journalists in L.A., Tommy Thompson and Ron Ridenour and some others, founded a paper to take up the gap that the failure of the FREEP caused. And we ended up having a PDID recruit.
PDID was
Malazzo,
what?
Spy on us by joining our staff.
Wait a minute. What is PDID so people understand?
Public Disorder Intelligence Division. It was the Red Squad.
Mm-hmm.
Right under Daryl Gates. And they sent 20 young, just graduated police academy recruits out to join about 200 organizations around L.A. that were progressive, and everything from, I think, they infiltrated Zev Yaroslavsky's city council office. They infiltrated groups like NOW and the Democratic Socialists, and they also had one of their members, a woman named Connie Malazzo, volunteered to be a wannabe reporter on our volunteer staff. So she was at our staff meetings. She was always offering generously to man the phones, woman the phones, while we would go out for lunch, which, of course, allowed her to rifle through our what were then Rolodexes to try to find our sources inside the police department and stuff. It was pretty ugly.
Huh. Okay. Well, that puts us off on a good start, because the name of your article is Police Brutality, a Nationwide Epidemic, the Big Lie About Police Brutality. What do you mean, a nationwide epidemic?
Well, I think what's happened is it's not any brilliant new idea I've had, but when you look at everything that's going on, you see that the police have become a paramilitary force in many, even most cities, and even in small towns. The police respond to almost every incident with a militaristic and very authoritarian and ultimately brutal manner. I mean, you talk back to a person, you're liable to be hammered to the ground. You're cuffed for almost anything. I was out hitchhiking in my town, as I do every once in a while, just to test the national zeitgeist and see whether people have any empathy. And this cop came up to me and told me that I couldn't hitchhike. It's illegal in Pennsylvania, which is untrue, and that if I did it, he would have to lock me up. And I said, lock me up? He was ready to just put the cuffs on and take me into prison for hitchhiking. And we're talking about a citation offense that has a $35 fine if you were doing it illegally, which would be like getting out in the road and impeding traffic. But I was on the grass. This is what sort of prompted me to write this, is that the realization that this guy could do that. And then you look at these videos of these. You had one, I think, in L.A. recently with a 34-year-old nurse who was thrown to the ground and body slammed by two LAPD cops, one of them a 20-year veteran with the rank of commander. And then they fist bumped after they'd smashed her to the ground twice. And her offense was they pulled her over for talking on her or texting on her cell phone.
And then there was the, just as heinous, the just savaging of this young guy.
The 19-year-old skateboarder.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that could have been me. I remember being busted by the LAPD for riding my bicycle the wrong direction on the street in Westwood. And the guy just slammed me against the car and then got my ID and all of this. And then he ran a make on me because maybe there'd be something else he could find me for. And it's like when I was in L.A., way back then even, it was they were doing these 5 a.m. raids on people who had outstanding warrants for things like a bald tire that hadn't been cleared with the court, or, you know, unpaid parking tickets. And so the community I was in Echo Park would have these things happening. But now it's much, much worse, because it's a sort of an entitlement that police feel they have to behave like an occupying army. And I think that it's not coincidental that a lot of these young cops that are doing this kind of behavior are veterans of the Iraq wars and the Afghan wars and, you know, Gulf wars, and they were an army of occupation in these countries. And so they bring that back. They get picked over other candidates. You know, they get a bonus for being a veteran. And then they have this attitude that they're in the occupation business here, particularly in the inner city, though, you know, where you're dealing with minorities, whether they're Latino or Black or Asian. And so they really feel, the cops that are outside of that ethnicity certainly feel that they are occupiers in a strange environment.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave is a founder of This Can't Be Happening, and he's also he's written an article that we're talking about, which is The Big Lie About Police Brutality, and Nationwide Epidemic. Now, Dave, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about when you're talking about this, you know, it's very interesting to me because there's a lot of what you're saying that I think is extremely important. And actually, just to start off, you know, one of the more heinous things I've seen in recent times around, and this is really saying something when it comes to the LAPD or any of the police. There was a woman, a Black woman who was lived in South Central. She took her kids and dropped them off at a police station. And she did this with the understanding, basically motivated by the fact that she couldn't take care of them anymore. She said she's a drug addict and she just was not able to take care of her kids. She didn't trust herself to take care of her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So she brought them to the police station. You know, if you're Bill Cosby, this is what you're telling people to do. Take responsibility. You know, she takes them to the police station. Instead of anything, instead of them taking the kids and taking care of them, getting them to a shelter or whatever, or to a relative, they come back to visit this woman, harass her, beat the hell out of her, and kill her.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the LAPD I'm familiar with.
And the heinous thing is that they're saying, well, what kind of mother was she?
You know, yeah, you're right.
They went after her to arrest her for endangering the lives of her children.
Yeah,
and
right.
They killed
well,
her.
They endangered her life. That's for sure.
Yeah.
No, I mean, this was a woman who needed A, she did the right thing, and B, she was someone who needed treatment, not an execution.
You know,
which is what that was.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that brings up to me is, I don't know if you've seen this report. It came out from, I think it was the Malcolm X Grassroots Committee a while back. And they, just in the middle of July, actually, and they did a study where they said 120 Black people executed without trial by police, security guards, and self-appointed law enforcers between January 1st and June 30th of 2012. And they make the point that the security guards and the self-appointed law enforcers like the Neighborhood Watch people or Zimmerman down in Florida mm-hmm. were a tiny number of these people who did it. Most of it was done by the police. If you think about this, actually, if you crunch the numbers, this means that one Black person was killed every 40 hours by police, security guards, and self-appointed law enforcers between January 1st and June 30th, 2012.
Yeah. I'm not surprised at all. Are you familiar with the case of the guy in Saginaw that was shot 46 times by six cops who had called 911 for police help because of a dispute he'd had with a shop owner? So he's a homeless man. He's out and known to police, not with a history of violence. He's out in the parking lot of this shopping mall, and six cops respond. They are standing. You can see in the video, which is there's a link on my site on that in that article. He's talking to them. He's angry. He had a knife in his hand, but it was a little knife, you know, like a pocket knife. And he's 20 feet away from them, and you see him turning to walk away from them when they start firing. Uh-huh. And then you just hear the bang, 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 bang. It was 46 shots, and of course he was dead. So that was an execution too of a you know, mentally unbalanced but non-threatening person. They're telling him drop the knife, but he's 20 feet away, and then he turns and is walking away from them when he's executed.
You know, it's
unbelievable.
Exactly. And actually, unfortunately, given the way things are these days, it's all too believable. Because, you know, I'm just thinking about the most recent thing, Reynaldo Cuevas in the Bronx, just over the weekend, who was mm-hmm. Was working in a grocery store. And, you know, these burglars came in, they tried to rob it. When the police came, they hid downstairs. Reynaldo ran out the front door looking for safety. He bumped into a cop, and the cop killed him.
Yeah, well, you know, he looked like the perp because he was a Latino.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, that's,
I mean, no, it's, yeah. it is unbelievable, but it is believable. And I, the other point I made was that the ease with which the police in New York and in Portland and in Los Angeles and in San Francisco and certainly in Oakland, you know, just morph into these uber military paramilitaries and, you know, just use extreme force against peaceful people in the occupation things is really indicative of the state of mind of these people. I mean, it shouldn't be that easy to turn a cop who's a civil servant into a paramilitary thug. And right. Yet it is. They slip right into it.
Just let me remind listeners that we're talking with Dave Lindorf. Dave is a journalist with This Can't Be Happening, and we're talking about the national epidemic of police brutality. Well, you know, part of this is, and there's a couple things I think, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. First, you know, there's a number of people who have raised the idea that, and it's related to what you were saying about, you know, the military training of a lot of these cops, that there's actually what's going on right now is sort of there's a counterinsurgency in operation right now when there's not yet an insurgency going on.
That's right. That's right. Look at all those bullets that the federal government is buying. It's like it's more bullets are being bought by Homeland Security than they were expending in Iraq at the height of the war. And these are hollow point bullets.
Wow.
45 millimeter and 9 millimeter hollow points.
You know, one of the things that happens is actually when you get this kind of counterinsurgency against an insurgency that doesn't quite exist yet, and it's related a lot to what they saw develop in the 60s and how to keep control of a very volatile section of people. But there's also this thing that comes out where we had in Anaheim, for instance.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, and where they slaughtered one kid after another. And all of the things that have happened, all these killings that have happened, whether it's New York, whether it's L.A., whether it's Chicago, whether it's Saginaw, Michigan, whatever. You know, the whole question of here's a situation where you have these young people, mostly young people being killed, people of color being killed, and yet every time there's some excuse that turns it around and blames it on the youth themselves or on the people themselves. And, you know, whether it's people are killed for mental illness, they're killed for drunkenness, they're killed because they happen to be young and Latino or black, perceived as a threat. And that's the thing is that every time it's justified and every time the police get off, I mean, very, very, very few police have ever been charged with murder. Murder for what they do to people.
Oh, yeah. And when they are charged, like they what happened, I think, in Oakland in that case where the guy just shot the guy who was sitting handcuffed at the BART station, and he just shot him in the head. And then he claimed, oh, I thought it was a taser. You
know? Right, yeah. Oscar Grant.
I mean, first of all, the guy was not acting up. He was sitting there with his hands behind him cuffed, and if the guy was going to taser him, that in itself would have been to the head. It was, you know, he shot him in the head. I mean, that's not where you aim the taser, but had he been doing that, it would have been pure torture. Right. That he was doing anyway, but he got off.
Now, you come from a city that is actually infamous for this kind of police brutality and police corruption. I mean, Philadelphia.
Yeah, that gets written about in the book about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. This city is it has a long history. The mayor Rizzo had been the police chief, and his whole approach was to, I mean, he in his police chief's car, he had a 3-foot-long baton that he used to like keep so he could come out whenever there was anything going on, and he'd be walking around with his own club that was twice the size of everybody else's. He was a big guy, and he just wanted his cops to be brutal. It was the way you were supposed to treat, particularly the black population of the city.
Yeah. Oh, boy, how the days have changed, huh?
Yeah, well, not.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah,
right. All right, Dave, we're going to have to move on. We're running out of time now. So
I would say that, you know, even though Philly now has a lot of black cops, the black cops participate in the beatings.
Absolutely.
It's a police mentality. It's not just a racial, white against black racial mentality.
Very,
that still is there.
Yeah, very important point, because a lot of times people think that, you know, well, if you just get black cops, you get Latino cops, the problem's solved. Actually, once someone becomes a cop and they take up this idea that the people are the enemy, and they're you know, people always say serve and protect, but actually they don't dig in deep enough about what the cops are actually serving and protecting. They're serving and protecting a whole setup in a society, and that's what
it
determines it, you know?
That's exactly right.
All right, Dave, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And and give people the name of your site real quick.
ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. Please go visit it.
All right, Dave. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with David Lindorf, journalist with This Can't Be Happening, and we've been talking with him about the national epidemic of police brutality. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Noche Diaz about the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement in New York City and all across the country. A movement that is taking shape on September 13th, really launching a whole campaign to stop, stop, and frisk and other forms of police brutality by people coming out and blowing the whistle on it, literally. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss that. All right, welcome back. That was Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation and their CD Radio Retaliation. Joining us now is Noche Diaz. Noche is a young revolutionary who faces years in jail if convicted on unjust charges. He has been arrested 5 times since October 2011 and has had 11 charges piled on him in 4 New York City boroughs, all for observing and protesting the illegitimate actions of the NYPD. Noche was one of the first members of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and helped organize protests that kicked off a citywide struggle against stop and frisk. He is well known to the people and to the NYPD for being a member of the People's Neighborhood Patrol of Harlem. Noche, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How you doing?
Very, very good, man, and really glad to be talking to you. You are part of this Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You're part of the whole movement around stopping stop and frisk. Can you tell people what that movement is, what's going on September 13th, and why it's important?
Okay, so the Stop Mass Incarceration Network was formed a little over a year ago by people like Cornel West and Carl Dix, looking at the situation for generations now of Black and Latinos who have been criminalized and are facing, you know, massive rates of incarceration and legalized discrimination in every sphere of society. And one of the first things that the network focused on taking on was stop and frisk in New York City. Back in October, Cornel West and Carl Dix issued the call for civil disobedience, where people began to really raise the fight against stop and frisk to another level. People had been speaking out against stop and frisk, and legal cases had been brought against it, but there had not been a public outcry and massive resistance. So people began this back in October. And this is also at the same time when I began to be targeted for my role in building for those protests. And so this September 13th is happening in the midst of huge controversy being sprouted open over stop and frisk over the last year. You know, there's been major demonstrations. There was that huge Father's Day march where, you know, thousands came out to march to demand an end to stop and frisk. And the answer from people like Bloomberg and Kelly has not been, well, we heard you, you protested. And it's been to come out with a full-scale assault on the people and point to the violence amongst the people to try to, you know, really win people over to supporting this stop and frisk policy. This 13th is going to be a crucial moment to really manifest this deep hatred that people have for the way that they're treated every day by these police.
Let me ask you this, Noche. Give people a sense of what stop and frisk is, because there's a lot of people all over the country who aren't necessarily clear on what stop and frisk is.
Sure. So, I mean, a stop and frisk is, you know, an official policy by the NYPD where they go out and as one of their main functions is to stop people and frisk them. And for example, you're coming home from work or maybe from school and you're walking down the street or you're, you know, maybe going up in your building and a cop basically has free rein to step to you, stop you and search your pocket and go through your bag and ask you questions about what you're doing. All this is supposed to be illegal under the Constitution, but for so many, especially Black and Latino youth in the inner cities of New York, their basic rights are violated every day. And if you talk back, if you assert your basic rights, you know, you could end up in jail, which could mess up your day, your week, and probably your whole life, because these cases get opened up on you from kids I've talked to as young as 14, 15, having legal cases open up on them simply because at any moment they know that some cop can step to them and violate them in any kind of way.
Now, one of the things that's happening here, I mean, one, you have to say, this is like a total degradation and dehumanization of a whole section of people who mainly are youth, who mainly are, you know, oppressed nationalities, Black and Latino, and they're basically, their basic humanity is being taken away from them simply because of the way they look.
I mean, it's definitely true. I mean, and there's, you know, this whole criminalization of the youth culture too, the sagging pan, the, you know, if you're wearing your hat a certain type of way or if you have a hip-hop vibe to you, you know, you can, you know, I've had some white kids get confused for Puerto Rican or whatever, tell me they get stopped by the police also because of, how they look. Basically, the criminalization of just generations. You know, when I was coming up, it was the, you know, the big baggy pants and the, you know, and the oversized shirts that was criminal. And now it's the pants that hang too low and the tight jeans and all that stuff.
It's really incredible. I mean, I was just reading a report that was put out by the Malcolm X Grassroots Committee, and they were a report that said 120 Black people were executed without trial between January 1st and June 30th of 2012. And one of the points they make is that 18% of the people killed were between 18 and 21 years old. 40% were between 22 and 31. So you have a huge, huge section of people, especially youth, that are being executed in this study. But I'm sure if you looked at the figures for people who basically were sent through a pipeline into prison, and I'm sure that if you look at the figures for this pipeline to prison that actually is very much connected up with stop and frisk, you'd find something very similar.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Stop and frisk is one of the frontline policies and programs that feeds this whole system of mass incarceration. And you do look at every level of this criminal justice system, so-called. They target that same section of the population, these young Black and Latino youth who they really have nothing else to do with. You go to these schools in these neighborhoods where the stop and frisk is practiced most frequently, and these schools are built like prisons in the first place. And then when you go in them, these youth are treated and herded around like cattle or like inmates in some kind of asylum. And they're treated like this even when they're not policed and put through the system. They're still treated like criminals just for they're not allowed to hang out on the street. They're not allowed to hang out in the school. They're not allowed to hang out around the school. They're chased off the corner of off the street. They're not allowed to wait at the bodegas for their friends. They're not allowed to wait at the bus stop unless they're standing close enough to the bus stop, or they'll get harassed by the police and threatened to be hauled off to jail. It's the same section of people that is constantly targeted on every level. You go inside the escalation of the incarceration rates for drug possession. It's been that same young Black and Latino that you enter the system at a young age and then you never get out of it.
Right.
You know, 2.5 million in prison, but then another 5 million who are on probation or parole and in some way tied up in this thing.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Noche Diaz, a young revolutionary based in New York City who is facing many charges and many years in jail. You are one of the people who have been stepping out against this, but you've also paid a price around this. And you have been attacked, assaulted, charged with many, many, many different charges. What is it, 11 charges?
Yeah, it's about 10 or 11. I think they're still debating on the last one.
Well, give people a sense of what your situation is, and including the most recent thing, which was something I know from personal experience. I know talking to people who were in the neighborhood that this occurred in, people were very inspired by what you did in terms of standing up against the kind of, actually brutal police terror.
Right. So like you said, I'm facing 10 or 11 charges resulting from 5 arrests in 4 different boroughs, with 4 trials coming up, facing years in prison. It started back again in October with the beginning of the fight against stop and frisk, where I was at the demonstration where Cornel West and Carl Dix were, together with another 30 some odd people, were committing civil disobedience. I was not part of the civil disobedience, but I was picked out of the crowd by the police and dragged out by my arms and legs and charged with resisting arrest, obstruction of government administration, and a second count of obstruction of government administration, because I'm known in that area for walking the streets with the People's Neighborhood Patrol to prevent the illegal actions of the police against the people. Since then, arrest after arrest, they've actually began to point to the fact that I am involved in all these situations to say, for the fact and prejudicially, that I must be guilty because there's a pattern of behavior here. Situation you talked about in the Bronx with a Black man who was being dragged out of his car by his dreadlocks and had his dreadlocks ripped out of his head and left on the streets and was being beaten in the middle of the street in front of a crowd of people who were being cursed at and yelled at by the police who were telling them to get out of there. It looked very much like one of those Oscar Grant situations where they could very well kill this person right in front of everybody. And because people, including myself, chose to exercise their basic right and observe the police and not walk away while someone was potentially going to be killed, myself and 2 other people who were watching were dragged off to jail and are facing charges in connection with that. But, like you said, people were very moved by that, and the person who was being beat is convinced that the fact that people acted is why he's still alive. In that case also, they've pointed to the fact that I've been involved in these other situations to say that this case should go forward and to paint a picture of a sort of a misfit and someone who likes to mess with cops as a pattern of behavior. But the pattern that is really demonstrated is that these police are doing this everywhere and that they are going to go after whoever it is that speaks out against. Then I have a few other cases. One of them being at a high school where the police were doing a similar thing where they arrested me for simply watching while they were sort of jumping at these youth who, this was in a situation where youth had been marching around demanding justice for Trayvon Martin, and the police lined up and threatened to drag them all off to jail. And so I walked many of them to the bus stops and the trains to make sure they got home safe, and some of them came up to me at a certain point and said the police had just thrown one of them through a plate glass window at the Chase Bank. So I went over that scene and saw them jumping at another youth, and when I went to speak up for them, they dragged me off to jail, and that's the one that is being consolidated with the arrest from October. And in that one case, I face up to 4.5 years in prison.
Wow. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Noche Diaz. Noche is a young revolutionary based in New York City, and he is part of the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Just amazing and incredibly enraging and amazing and actually inspiring in a sense of you stepping up and standing up to this, which is what I want to lead into now, because September 13th, why don't you tell people what September 13th is about? Because I'm looking at it, I'm thinking in a way it's kind of sounding an alarm and sounding a call, a clarion call to people to step up against this and not allow this stuff to go down without opposition.
Well, that's a very good description, but it's also like it's a sort of a beginning of a new day kind of thing, where on that day we're going to model a certain kind of activity that many, many people can begin to take up and actually build that form of resistance, and so that these police cannot just get away with violating people's basic rights in silence, isolating people, picking them off, and then blaming them for the way they're being victimized. On September 13th, you know, when people around New York City, but then also around the country, who are stepping out in different ways and are blowing the whistle when they see these police racially profiling or in other ways harassing and brutalizing people. This is a very, very, very crucial beginning of a form of activity that many, many people can begin to take up who are directly the victims of it, and then people who know this goes on and hate it and also enter into this form of activity. They can be out there with their whistles, blowing the whistle every time they see this recording, but also being there to support those who are taking this kind of step. We've already seen some examples of this and how powerful it is. There's been a few examples actually in the Bronx, but most recently after the murder of Reynaldo Cuevas, there was a march in the neighborhood where hundreds of whistles were gotten out, and the entire neighborhood was just alive with the sound of whistles. You know, it was really like music, and it was empowering, and people felt that. And it was both the people who were angry at the fact that this person had just been murdered, but it was also many people who just hate the way that they have to live, constantly being victimized and brutalized by the way that the police just have free rein on them. And it was, you know, every time a cop tried to walk up to somebody and tell them something that wasn't right, people were blowing the whistle and making so much noise, and they would just drown it out. And it was very powerful. And you saw this also again in the Bronx, in the playgrounds, where these young people, you know, play and they get harassed by the police. Every time a cop car would come by, a kid would ride by in their scooter and start screaming, "It's whistle time," and everybody would start blowing their whistles together, and so they would alert each other, and everybody would be watching out for each other and having each other's backs. It's a very exciting day to be looking forward to, and I hope to hear reports from all over the country of what people have done to step out and to really model this form of activity.
All right, Noche, so people are going to be blowing their whistles all over the country on stop and frisk, on police brutality, on all of this on September 13th. Noche, thank you very much for joining us today, and we will have you back to follow up on your cases as they develop. So thanks a lot for being here, man.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking with Noche Diaz, a young revolutionary based in New York City, who is part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and also he's part of the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement that was launched by Carl Dix and Cornel West. And Noche is currently facing a number of charges and many years in jail for standing up to police brutality. All right, if you want to find out more about the movement to Stop, Stop, and Frisk or Stop Mass Incarceration, you can go to stopmassincarceration.org. Again, that's stopmassincarceration.org. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Marjorie Cohn, Dave Lindorf, and Noche Diaz. I also want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com.